The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the largest city in New Hampshire and the largest city north of Boston, the Queen City of Manchester has a long history, from its start as an industrial center in Milltown to a present-day hub for tech companies. Manch Vegas, as it is lovingly referred to by residents, gets a lot of attention in election years as a popular stop for candidates and news crews, but our next guest thinks it deserves the royal treatment every year. Will Stewart is a Southern expat, now Manchester resident, and author of a forthcoming guidebook all about the Queen City, from Hanover Hill to Wombeck Mill, an insider's guide to Manchester. Will, thanks for coming all this way from Manchester.
Thank you, for Virginia.
You're not a Manchester native. When did you move to
I moved 12 years ago. So in the fall of 2004, I moved up from Tennessee, sight unseen, to the wild, cold, frozen Manchester, New Hampshire.
What brought you up here?
I was in journalism at the time and took a job writing as a reporter for The Hippo in Manchester, a local alt-weekly there.
So when did you realize that Manchester needed a guidebook?
Well, you know, I'd always been fascinated with the city, and perhaps it was coming with kind of fresh eyes and kind of seeing it anew. And, I've always found it interesting. But I was kind of dismayed through the years that a lot of people didn't seem to share my fascination and love of the city. And it really came to a head back in 2012 during the primary. And, a number of, as you mentioned, a lot of reporters are coming from all over the country and all over the world and reporting from Manchester. It's kind of ground zero for the primary. And so it was always Dateline Manchester. And usually they'd give just a kind of a cursory description of the city. It really didn't go beyond that. And the words they chose to describe the city were always invariably something like challenged or gritty. Something my favorite, you mentioned Manch Vegas being one of the nicknames. Manchganistan was the one that really caught my attention. And I admit it did make me laugh a little bit. But, all of that together kind of made me realize that, Manchester is really, it's misunderstood, I think, by a lot of outsiders. And it's unappreciated by those who live in the city itself.
What are the origins of Manch Vegas? Did you ever find that out?
I've heard and read various things. The one that has the most street cred is that the city, particularly back in the 80s, it was kind of a big draw, and people would come on Elm Street and cruise up and down, and said it kind of had the bright lights of Vegas. Manch Vegas.
I heard a rumor that there were underground casinos.
That's another one as well. And slot machines that paid out in the back room and those kinds of things. So I'd say there's probably a little truth to all of them.
Well, a lot of the city's history is based around the Mill Yard, which was where you started the book. How does the Mill Yard define the city today?
Well, I think it's the first thing that oftentimes people see. The first time I came to Manchester, I was coming up 93, took 293, and you kind of round the curve around the Merrimack, and you just see these mills, these massive brick buildings. They just really, they almost assault you. And I say that in a loving way, but they're the defining characteristic of the city, and they're such a fact that you can't ignore them. And Manchester from the beginning has been a company town until the demise of the Amersfoort Manufacturing Company during the Depression. But even so, it's from a physical standpoint, defines the city still, and I think it's deep in the psyche of Manchester. It will always be there.
And now the site of a number of tech companies and startups.
Correct, and I think it's really kind of a metaphor for the city itself. It's gone from being a company town, one industry, textiles, and they had a few other industries there too. But with the collapse of the company, the city, the Mill Yard, and the city itself really had to transform itself, and that's what it's done over the years. And going from textiles to really an assortment of tech, but also the Mill Yard is home to all kinds of things, from climbing gyms to retail shops to cafes and coffee shops, and it really kind of runs the gamut. And it's a much more diverse place these days, and I think that's the lesson that Manchester has taken. We're not putting all our eggs in one basket anymore.
Another population, the French Canadians, who did come and answer the demand for workers at the Amersfoort mills in the 1800s. How does their legacy live on in Manchester?
Well, the west side of Manchester, of course, is the traditionally French or Quebecois side of the city. But I'll also note that it's not just the French Canadians that originally made the city diverse. They were the largest wave and the most well known. But you also had a number of everyone from Belgians to Greeks to Ukrainians and Irish, of course. They came in to work in the mills and make the city home. And Manchester's always been a multicultural city. I think today it's definitely the most diverse city in the state, and you really owes that legacy, to the Amiskegs and to the Amiskeg and to the French Canadians who were kind of the pioneers of that.
We're getting the insider secrets to Manchester, New Hampshire from Will Stewart, who is putting together a guidebook about the Queen City, From Hanover Hill to Wombeck Mill, An Insider's Guide to Manchester. You said earlier that Manchester, it's secret to a lot of people. People don't know what's really going on, even for people who've lived there for years. What do you think it is about Manchester that makes it secretive?
I've thought about this, and not to get too existential, but I think it's kind of a piece of New Englanders in general, I think, tend to be, very, hold the cards close to the vest, and I'm just going to do my work, and, you do yours, I'll mind my own business, you mind yours, and I'm not going to toot my own horn. And I think that's part of Manchester's challenge, is that it's always been a no-nonsense, city that does what it does, and that's enough. It's never really had, we have the Chamber of Commerce, like any city, and now it has an economic development office, that's working to, wave the flag. But it's really, I think, like a lot of New England cities and states, does a poor job of celebrating itself and really talking about all the good things. And so as a result, there are all these great things. I like to say Manchester is a city of best kept secrets precisely for that reason. I mean, for example, I think of there's a weekly poetry slam, very well known and well regarded across the country in Manchester, in the Mill Yard, in fact, Slam Free or Die. There's a monthly silent film screening, at the library, done by a local guy named Jeff Rapsis, who provides piano accompaniment.
He's been on the show before.
Yeah.
That's great.
So you have all these great, quirky little things. We were talking before we went on the air about a great little Vietnamese restaurant on Lincoln Street. It's very unassuming, but the noodles are great, and the iced coffee, the Vietnamese iced coffee is great. I mean, we have some great big attractions that people do know about, your Courier Museum and your Mill Yard Museum and great restaurants like the Puritan Back Room and the Red Arrow. But, for all of those well-known establishments, there are so many more unknown or relatively unknown establishments that I wanted to kind of help bring into the limelight and really show people what a great city it is because we have all these things.
So are you willing to show us your aces there? I mean, any deep secrets that you want to share?
Well, there are so many to mention. In the book, we have 500 individual listings from
wow.
Restaurants like the Vietnamese place. Also places like Cafe Momo is probably my favorite restaurant
yes.
in the city. And then a lot of the interesting events and happenings, I think, too, that are kind of secretive, like the Granite State Comic Con. That we have, and like the Live Free or Die Tattoo Expo that happens. I mean, who would think of something like that? But these things are huge. We have, a marching band competition, every year, over at Memorial High School, where you have professional marching bands from all across the Northeast and Canada. Fascinating little things. There's a train car over on the west side called the Mercy Train Car. It was apparently back after World War II, every state in the Union received a boxcar, like a train boxcar, filled with goodies from France as a thank you for liberating the country during the war. Most, I think, have been lost to history across the country, but New Hampshire is just sitting off this little side street on the west side of Manchester, the French west side, encased in a little glass building. It's just a weird little facet of history.
Well, connecting all of these secrets, you've got an illustrator working with you to create a map or illustrate some of these sites?
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
A guy named Peter Noonan, a very well-known and respected illustrator in Manchester. People will often remember him from a big mural he had on the old Merrimack restaurant on the corner of Merrimack and Elm a few years ago, talking about the primary and painting some of the contenders, there. The book is divided into chapters by neighborhood or
mm-hmm.
sections of the city. So he'll be doing a little map of each neighborhood, as well as some illustrations of, perhaps the Mercy boxcar, what I call the door to nowhere, another little odd and end that's in the official term is the town pound door, back in back in the day, way back, 16, 1700s, each town would have a pound where loose, stray animals, farm animals, were kind of gathered up and kept in a pen. Well, all that exists in Manchester these days, or Derryfield, as it was known originally, is just this door. And it's kind of a wooden door, has a little cement deal around it. That's it, just a door. So he'll be drawing little things like that, maybe some iconic signs, from across the city, from like, Creamland or the Puritan back room, to really bring some of these things to life.
I understand you're doing a Kickstarter campaign to help fund this.
That is correct,
how
yes.
How is that going?
So far, so good. It runs through the end of October. Anyone can see it, link to it. We have a video that kind of explains the project. If you want to go to manchguide.com, that's the website for the book that can tell you a little bit more about it, but also links to the Kickstarter campaign as well.
That sounds great. It sounds like you're going to have this out before the next influx during the primary.
That is the goal, yes. The goal is to have it funded, printed, and shipped in time for the holidays. So if you're looking for a good Christmas or Hanukkah gift, go to manchguide.com.
Will, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Will Stewart, he's a community organizer. He's an expat from the South and author of the forthcoming book, From Hanover Hill to Wombeck Mill, An Insider's Guide to Manchester. You can read more about the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Home ownership for generations, a patch of land and a home for raising a family represented a safe, attainable way of pitching a stake in the American dream. Today, dreaming of the perfect home is entertainment.
But one specific item on her wish list might be tricky.
I don't want a lot of trees around the house because I just don't like the sound of birds chirping in the morning. It's not that I don't like birds. It's just that I don't like them chirping like 4 a.m.
That's a clip from House Hunters, which, along with a bunch of spin-off shows and websites like Zillow, Curbed, and Easy Street, have made real estate addictive, indulging the homeowner fantasies of tens of millions of people with none of the anxiety and no down payment. Willa Paskin is Slate's TV critic who wrote about how Zillow and House Hunters and their like have made all of us into real estate experts. And Willa, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I love the title of the article in Slate, 110 Million Open Houses. What is it about glimpsing at someone else's home that is so appealing?
I mean, I think it almost feels like it's tapping into some lizard part of our brain that just wants to see where other people live. There is something that is so interesting and always is interesting about seeing how, like, not only the physical space, but how it's decorated of a stranger or an acquaintance's home, like what the insides look like. I mean, the thing is, when you go into someone's house, you can just tell so much about them, even more than from what they're wearing. You can tell their sophistication. You can tell sort of their taste. You can tell their ambition. You can tell their terrible taste. I mean, there's just so much available. There, every item is a clue. And also, I think, in a way, it's also sort of taps into some of the same things that are fun about shopping, which is it's like you are always comparing it to what you have or what you would like, or getting ideas or feeling happy that you would never want that particular armoire or whatever. It's almost like, in a certain way, there's something ineffable about it because it's just really fun to look at people's houses.
Right. And like walking into someone's house when you're watching television or clicking through houses on Zillow, nobody's seeing you, right?
Totally. You get to be totally nosy without anyone having to know that you're nosy.
So do you think that's what's behind it, sort of being nosy, getting a glimpse into the lives of others? Or, what is it, aspirational? Why can people spend hours and hours just looking through someone else's, other people's houses on Zillow?
I think there is something it's hard to explain about what itch it scratches in our minds. I mean, I think there is a curiosity, of course. There are things to covet. There's a sort of an acquisitive desire there. But I think also, it's really interesting to see houses that are disgusting and you'd never want to live in either. So, and that can be sort of pleasurable in a different way than just aspirational. Like, it's not only houses that you wish you could have that can be fun to look at.
Zillow is just one of these sites that shows you houses, that you can shop for houses. But also there are other sites where you can gossip about them.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that there's been a kind of democratization of real estate that is similar to lots of other arenas of our culture. I mean, I think there's probably a pretty close parallel, although it's like less discussed, with food culture and real estate culture, which is like, we all have always had to eat. We've all always had to have shelter. But in the last decade, foodie culture has completely taken off. And there's ways that, you know, talking about restaurants and where people eat and what kind of things they're eating and if it's organic and where it comes from has supplanted talking about films or music or even television as a sort of party chatter. And there's a way that I think talking about apartments or houses and how much they cost and who's living where and the entire market going up and down and the economy collapsing is also has become a very common sort of cocktail party conversation. That these things have sort of become cultural objects in a way they used to just be sort of like physical necessities. And there are all these websites that cater to that. I mean, there's tons of websites about food and there's tons of websites about housing and about design and about architecture. And I think that the more of those things that there are, the more interested people are. And in the past, there obviously was like Architectural Digest and sort of higher end magazines about it, but it was catering to people who were sort of insiders, who were real estate agents or architects or knew the lingo. And now there's just, it's just a more mass product and more people can be involved in it.
Well, and of course, Home and Garden Television, this is this whole other universe, which I think you sort of pegged to starting with House Hunters back in 1999. Why do you think that so captivated people?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think it started with House Hunters. House Hunters started in 1999, but there was other shows at the time that were more popular, like Trading Spaces or Extreme Home Makeover, sort of a bunch of sort of more high profile shows. But House Hunters has had extremely crazy longevity, which is to say it's still on the air 17 years later. And in 1999, they probably made 20 episodes a year. It's something around there, a normal amount. And now House Hunters and all of its spinoffs, of which there are an enormous number, they're in production for over 500 episodes a year. The network HGTV airs 2 episodes a night that are new in addition to reruns. So it's just a huge number of that of like episodes of this one show that sort of always has a very, very similar format. And it's attracting over 30 million people a month, which is an enormous number as well. This show that's like extremely soothing in a strange way.
I love that point there. You know, unlike in the real world, real estate, things often go wrong. But on House Hunters, things always seem to work out.
Yeah, I mean, buying a house or not being able to afford having a house or having a house and wanting another house or having to do renovations. I mean, all of these things are actually really stressful. You know, real estate is a really stressful time in people's lives. I actually talked to someone from HGTV and he said, you know, they've done all these surveys and basically it's like having a baby and buying a house are like the two most, you know, disruptive and stressful experiences in people's lives over and over again. And House Hunters kind of turns that into, you know, what's going to happen every single episode. And so it's just become sort of mellowing and interesting and without any of the stressful parts.
And all of these spinoffs, House Hunters International, renovation, you know, international renovation, all this happened when the real estate market was tanking. So is there a sort of disconnect between real life and what happens on House Hunters?
Well, yeah, I think there is. And I don't think that that's actually at all surprising about why House Hunters would be even more popular. I mean, I think as the real world, as particularly real estate in the real world, gets extremely stressful, as, you know, the housing market collapsed, as even though we're sort of into the recovery, fewer people own homes now than they have in decades. It's much harder to get a mortgage than it was. I mean, the ripple effects of this continue. It's really nice to watch a show where everything is working exactly as it should, right? Where real estate just functions, where you don't ever get outbid, where you know you can always afford the place that you bought, that you never get a lemon, that you never purchased a house and you can't afford it and you know you have to leave. It's like in the context of a crisis, it seems even more obvious why it would be comforting.
Well, Willa, thank you for letting us into this housing universe.
Thanks for having me.
Willa Paskin, Slate's television critic, who recently wrote 110 Million Open Houses, Zillow, House Hunters, and How Real Estate Became Entertainment. You'll find a link to read her article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
in the family room, right off the kitchen.
Okay.
This is huge.
This is amazing.
Huh? This is too big of a room, my point of view.
And what?
How are you going to clean that upstairs here? There's a huge window. Can you reach that?
You will figure a way.
Cedric, have you ever cleaned a window?
Yes. No.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Arctic explorer Henry Hudson set sail from England 400 years ago in search of the Northwest Passage, which would cut down travel time on trading routes between Europe and Asia. Instead of finding the passage, he was marooned in what is now known as Hudson Bay, a region that remains mysterious today. Reporter Emily Corwin found a contemporary Arctic explorer searching for answers.
My name is Lawrence Millman, and I'm an Arctic explorer. And I have an abiding interest in other Arctic explorers who disappeared off the face of the earth.
On a modern-day expedition to the Hudson Bay, Larry Millman overheard an unusual story about the first white man to live among that region's native Cree. The story had been passed down among the Cree for generations, and the white man was known as Firebeard.
With very little research, I determined that in all probability, Firebeard was Henry Hudson, who was perhaps the best recognized navigator of his day.
There are only a few things we know about Henry Hudson's personal life.
Here's one of the things we know about Henry Hudson, that he had a great affection for bangles, like jewelry, and males wore in those days lots of jewelry, like bracelets. He liked golden wristbands and rings. We know that. And there's one source that mentioned that he really enjoyed big meals.
Back in the early 1600s, navigators were tired of sailing down around South America, all the way across the Pacific to Asia. So a British trading company hired Henry Hudson to find a shorter route.
Well, he sets out from England in 1610. Touches Iceland, gets some supplies, and heads into the furious overfall, otherwise known as Hudson Strait. They thought, because of all these heavy currents, that it was close to the Pacific. It had to be a great ocean. No, it wasn't a great ocean. It was a long, narrow strait.
This so-called furious overfall, with its counterclockwise swirling chunks of ice, was much, much colder than the guys on Hudson's crew ever expected. Pretty soon, their ship got stuck. It was mired in the ice.
There's a feeling of complete and utter paralysis. You might like to go somewhere, but you can't go anywhere. You can't get your boat to move a bloody inch.
Hudson's crew wanted to turn around. They said,
as soon as we get out of this ice, Captain Hudson, we're heading home. There was an interesting democracy among crews of that day. If the crew wanted to head home and the captain didn't, the crew got their way. He said, well, look, he brought out a map. He showed his crew the map. He said, we're 100 miles farther west than any other known expedition, and you want to turn around. Well, they couldn't turn around, and he was using that possibly as part of his ammunition.
We stand now on the edge of discovery. This great bay must open somewhere and yield the passage. Let us thrust westward in the common triumph of raising the Indies.
That's from the 1964 film The Last Voyage of Henry Hudson. Come November, it was too cold and icy to go on. Hudson and his crew would spend the winter camped on the shore of the frigid James Bay.
It was just an absolute miracle that they survived the winter.
The crew was starving, and it was freezing cold. Scurvy made their gums bleed and their teeth loose. When the ship could finally sail again, Hudson told his crew they would return to England. But there was a problem.
Hudson wasn't going in the right direction for England. He was heading west, and he should have been heading north, up along the coast and out the same way they came in. And when one of the members of the crew noticed that certain individuals had cheese and had more food than they themselves had, that was the spark that inspired the mutiny.
Now that you're free of us, Master Hudson, you may sail westward for all you are worth.
Mr. Green, it is not too late. Reconsider.
The crew threw Hudson and his son on a sailboat and headed right back to England. Did Hudson go by Firebeard and live among the Cree? Or did he freeze to death alone in the bay? We don't know. 400 years later, another adventurous Arctic explorer wanted her turn. The legend of Henry Hudson loomed.
Every time I brought up Hudson Strait, everybody just shook their head. It had this reputation for being a really tough place where to work.
That's Fiamma Stranio. She's an ocean scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. 3 years in a row, Stranio has returned to the same place where Henry Hudson disappeared. She's not looking for riches or spices or any of that. And none of her crews have ever threatened mutiny. See, Stranio is on a new kind of mission. She wants to understand climate change in the Arctic.
And so if we think of Hudson Bay and Hudson Strait as a small microcosm in the climate system, then if I can understand how they work, if I know what goes in and I know what comes out, then I can put this in a bigger model that has the entire planet, the entire atmosphere, and it's going to help us predict future change.
As the planet heats up, moisture evaporates from warm places like the tropics, and then wind pulls that moist air over the Arctic, where it rains and snows into the ocean. That fresh water is lighter than the salt water, so it sits like a blanket on top of the entire ocean, getting in the way of the ocean's usual temperature regulation and circulation patterns. Stranio is monitoring the water in the Hudson Strait, a bottleneck that connects the Hudson Bay to the Atlantic Ocean. This is the strait that Henry Hudson may have called the Furious Overfall, with its massive 30-foot tides and swirling currents.
When you're close to land, you just see the entire landscape change. You know, your ship just goes up and down, and you look and you thought, oh, there was an island there. Well, it's gone. Because there are these super strong tides, the everything that you see are these really fast currents, which switch every 6 hours or so. And there's so much mixing and turbulence that the water literally boils.
Here is Stranio in the same treacherous strait that brought about Henry Hudson's demise 400 years ago.
And so if you read the old books and the old maps, Hudson Strait is actually indicated with a waterfall. Like the currents were so strong that ships had a really hard time navigating it.
There are a couple of maps that actually show Hudson Bay long before any European went there. Here be dragons, here be monsters, or you fall off the edge at this point.
The legends of monsters that tormented Henry Hudson's crew boded ill for Stranio's expedition. Yet Stranio forged ahead. For her research, she puts three chains of instruments down into the water. These chains, called moorings, are so big they have to be lowered in with a crane. What looks like a massive red fishing bobber sits at the top while the instruments sink down, measuring water salinity, velocity, and temperature.
I think the most exciting moment was putting everything in the water the first time. Just seeing everything disappear, it feels silly because that's it. You've just chucked hundreds of thousands of dollars in the water. Don't know what they're doing. But just putting everything in and know that if everything goes as planned, you're going to come back and there'll be data. And there's something magical about letting go of all the instruments and just sort of walking away and trusting.
Stranio's reward for taking on this challenge is getting to be the first.
One of the reasons to work in the Arctic is that it's an incredibly important place in the circulation of the ocean and the climate system, and yet we know so little about it. And so you can go to so many places in the Arctic and be the first person ever making measurements there. And so when you pull up this instrument that's been in the water for an hour or for a year, and you look at these data, you think, wow, nobody's ever seen what goes on under the surface of the ocean here. You're sort of hearing a story for the first time.
Kind of like when Larry Milman heard the story of Firebeard for the first time. For Milman, being in a place like the Hudson Bay gave him something else, too, a new kind of sensory experience.
When you're in a place that you know each wrong step will land you in, if not trouble, deep doo-doo, bear, caribou or otherwise, and you're aware of the world around you. So I enjoy this, the fact that all my senses are on the alert when I'm traveling in the Arctic.
Larry Milman left the Arctic with a new kind of awareness and a story about Henry Hudson. Henry Hudson's mutinous crew left Henry in the middle of the Hudson Strait. And Stranio left the Hudson Strait with the data she needed to build a predictive model of climate change in the Arctic. All of them did something that had never been done before, in a place no one, except perhaps the native Cree, was meant to survive. For Living on Earth, I'm Emily Corwin.
I have traveled the world around, wandered far from home.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Atlas Obscura is not your typical travel guide. It won't point out the best restaurants in London or Paris, or the best views of the pyramids of Giza or Stonehenge. But if you're the kind of person who would rather visit a 2,300-year-old mummy in Denmark, a Namibian ghost town, or Minnesota's Museum of Questionable Medical Devices, then this is the guidebook for you. And best of all, you can still enjoy it without going anywhere. Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the world's hidden wonders, compiles some of the oddest places from the delightfully addictive Atlas Obscura website into a hefty book. Ella Morton is co-author of the book with Joshua Foer and Dylan Thuris. Ella, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So this has long been a sort of collaborative project, begun with some exploring souls, but also a number of people submitted sites to you, submitted different kind of excursions and experiences. How did you choose them for this book?
Well, it was really difficult because the website Atlas Obscura began in 2009 as a collaboration between Josh and Dylan. They started listing their favorite places that they had come across, and then they started inviting contributions from people around the world. And we've now gotten about 10,000, so we had to choose 700 for this book. And it was a really difficult process to narrow it down, but we tried to go for a balance both geographically and in terms of the categories of places. So we didn't want to have too many natural wonders or too many one-person art projects or anything in one particular category. So I think we found a good balance.
Mm, there are some really remote places, you know, subterranean caves or water cages. Can all of these places conceivably be visited, or could one even get access to them?
Almost all of them. Some access would be quite difficult in that you would have to perhaps bribe a security guard or get, in the case of Snake Island, get permission from the Brazilian Navy because it's simply too dangerous to go to an island full of lethal snakes. But technically, I'd say about 95% of the places in the book are definitely places that you can visit.
It would be quite a thing to see even a quarter of them. I was really interested in the Icelandic Elf School in Reykjavik. What do people study there?
Oh, they study mythology and folklore. Those creatures, elves in particular, are huge in Iceland. In fact, there was a politician who got involved in a car crash, and there was a rock that he said saved him from death because elves were living there and they managed to put his car out of harm's way, and he actually moved the rock to his yard as a way of keeping himself safe. So they're definitely part of the mythology of the country, and there's this school in Reykjavik where you can learn about them and other mythical creatures.
It's great. You get a diploma in hidden people research.
Yes, exactly.
But there are so many crazy, wonderful places. The Buddhist temple shrine for the souls of insects that died for science. I mean,
yes.
What goes on there?
It's just this little boulder in Japan. This guy was putting a textbook together, and for that he had to unfortunately kill some insects because it was based on the biology of some of these creatures. And so as a way of saying thank you to these insects for sacrificing their bodies, he made a monument to them. So it's a little respectful thing to all the flies and mosquitoes that had to give up their lives.
What is the kind of craziest museum, or what comes to mind when I say a museum that is in the book that you just never would have imagined otherwise?
There are so many. We always say that the best museums are the ones with the fewest hours open and the fewest people involved. One of my favorites is in Independence, Missouri, and it's run by this one woman, Layla, and it's a hair museum, but particularly Victorian hair art. So you'll see these objects that look like jewelry or just old sort of rusty jewelry, but when you get up close, you'll see that they're made from woven human hair. That's one of my favorites.
There are so many places that I think, you know, kind of run this line between passion and there's kind of madness. Did you look at these sites and just think people are just mad?
Yeah, or I mean, I guess the charitable way to spin it would be to say creative. There's one place that I love in the Baltimore Medical Examiner's office. There are all these little dioramas that look like dollhouses, but they're full of scenes of murder. And they were made by this woman, Frances Glessner Lee, in the 1940s before forensic science became more established. And they were used as teaching aids at Harvard for students studying forensic science. But that's an example of one of those things that is so creative, but also just really off-kilter and unexpected. It's these really delicately made, hand-sewn, beautifully detailed dollhouses full of blood and death.
The fascination with death is also really interesting because you see it in so many cultures from so many different parts of history. There's a death road in a Bolivian mountainside. You know, it runs along this 2,000-foot abyss. And it becomes famous because so many people were killed there. So people go and see it because people die there. What did you learn looking at all this about that human fascination with death and memorializing?
Well, it is fascinating to see how different cultures and different people approach it, because you would sort of assume, especially within America, that it's something that's very somber or like it's a thing to gawk at. There are so many places in this book that challenge that idea. There's the Merry Cemetery in Romania, where there are all these colorful tombstones that have stories of the deceased people's last moments. And in some cases, it even has a pictorial depiction of their last moments, which can be a bit of a bit of black humor. But and then there's things like these coffins that are made in West Africa that are, you can have like a giant sneaker or a ballpoint pen. You can be buried in a giant lion. So these treatments of death that are sort of unexpected, they're the ones that fascinate me.
So these are sort of creations made by human beings or practices practiced by human beings. How about sort of historical things, you know, something that we might not know about history because it wasn't a tourist site necessarily to go and see?
Sure. Well, there are lots of ruins that are a little bit uncertain what happened there. There's actually a Stonehenge in New Hampshire that is of indeterminate origin, and people have a lot of theories about it.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. So I guess it depends on your interpretation as to how old it was. But its carbon dating has, I think it's from the second millennium BC. The ruins are not a lot to look at, but that tends to happen when there's not a lot left. People tend to put their own theories on.
But, you know, you're also pointing out something that you might say or hear about the American Stonehenge in New Hampshire and make a trek there and go, and it's not really that much to look at. It's not necessarily the site, is it?
Right. And I mean, then you have things like there's a plaque in Boston that commemorates the Great Boston Molasses Flood. And, you know, it's a piece of metal, but the event is so much more dramatic and astounding than the actual thing that's left. So that was another thing that we had to decide when choosing what to put in the book is, do you prioritize what you can actually go there and see, or do you prioritize the story? Because sometimes one outweighs the other.
So many interesting, crazy places. I can't help but wonder, it being near Halloween and there being a number of creepy places, where would you send us for Halloween, Ella? You know, enchanted forests, haunted hotels, mouths of hell?
Well, that is what the Gates of Hell, or the Daughter Hell, is one that's an evergreen favorite. It's this 200-foot wide flaming hole in the Turkmenistan desert that does look like an entrance to hell. And the origin story of it is totally bizarre, because what happened was in 1971, these Soviet geologists were drilling in the desert and they happened upon this pocket of methane, but it was a giant hole, so their drilling rig fell in. And what they did to kind of cover up the problem was to set it on fire. But the problem was it didn't burn for a few days or a few weeks. It's been burning for 45 years so far. But it's an incredible sight. 200-foot wide flaming hole, Turkmenistan desert. I think that would be a good place to go for Halloween.
It inspires so much wonder looking at this. I loved there was a blurb from Lena Dunham who said, you know, I'm pathologically afraid of the great unknown, so I can just experience it like this. And I'm wondering what for you, you know, you're the person who became immersed in this, piecing this all together. What sense of the world did it give you, or did it change the way that you look at the world?
It definitely did. I think the main thing was we never regarded this book as a list of places that people should go. Like, it's not meant to be something that you check off a list on. It's about collecting places that show you what is possible in the world and what is going on out there that can still inspire awe. Because I think, you know, it's easy to get cynical about what's out there. It seems like everything's been discovered and talked about. But when you flip through these pages and you see what people are doing creatively, or what natural wonders there are, or what architecture there is, it's just incredible. So I think that's the main thing that I've got from this, is a sense of what's possible.
Any place you're dying to see, Ella?
Ooh, I have so many on the list. There is this one place called California City, which is about 100 miles north of Los Angeles, and it was meant to be this huge city, this metropolis that would rival L.A. And this guy tried to set it up in the late 1950s by establishing all the roads and naming all the roads, but then people didn't end up moving in. So it just looks like, from an aerial view, it looks like a giant circuit board. It's just a bunch of roads. It's a ghost town. And we've done trips with Atlas Obscura. Our LA faction has sent a bunch of people out there to just roam these streets that are now being taken over by sand. I would love to see that. It looks incredible.
Well, Ella, thank you for giving us so many more things to think about.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Ella Morton, she is co-author with Joshua Four and Dylan Thuris of Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the world's hidden treasures. There is so much more on the book for you to look at. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free and David Seste. There's more on the music and more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also find us on Twitter at Word of Mouth, on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio, and our podcast is Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes and on Google Play, where we hope you will choose to rate it. That way other people can find it. That is the power you have when sharing by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.